Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We made this.
There's one thing I always meant to ask Jack. Back in the old days, I wanted to know about that doctor of his. The man who appears out of nowhere and saves the world, except sometimes he doesn't. All those times in history when there was no sign of him, I wanted to know why not. But I don't need to ask anymore. I know the answer now. Sometimes the doctor must look at this planet and turn away in shame. I'm recording this in case anyone ever finds it, so you can see. You can see how the world ended.
Welcome to the TARDIS Crew, a Doctor Who podcast for the We Made This podcast network. I'm Baz Greenland, and this week we are continuing our discussion on Torchwood: Children of Earth with my son Ben and, of course, returning guest Darren Mooney. So last week, you'll have heard us talk about Torchwood in general. We did a bit of a deep dive into the kind of main themes of Torchwood: Children of Earth. And then we did an even deeper dive into episodes 1 and 2. So today we are going to continue that discussion, look into the real kind of meat of the story, that is episodes 3, 4 and 5. So let's jump into episode 3 then. So Darren, this is kind of where we really get into the crux of what this is all about. What did you think of those scenes with the arrival of 4, 5, 6 and their interactions in Tim's house with Frobisher?
I mean, like, the 4, 5, 6 are just a wonderful creation. Like, again, is it their voice? But is it Simon Poland is the actor?
Yeah, amazing voice. Yeah.
Amazing voice performance. But, like, the way in which they're created, they're, again, they're puppets, which is great. Everybody loves a practical effect. The way in which they are clouded in gas so that you don't get to see a lot of them. Mm. The fact that when you do see them, it's often through monitors, which means that the image gets to be static, which means that it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be created by CGI. You can use puppets for that. They're very unsettling. They're very effective. Things like the juxtaposition of the very smooth, very commanding, like, English voice that they deliver, and then the occasional, like, weird thrashing and screaming and projection of, like, green bile onto the glass. And the fact that that is never explained, like, it's never explained when it does that. Is it, like, an involuntary thing when they're, you know, angry? Is it something, like, as we find out later, possibly to do with withdrawal? Is it just a natural thing that their species does at random intervals? Like, you know, hawking up a cat coughing up a fur ball. I love that the show never explains any of that. And again, the show keeps the 4, 5, 6 mysterious because they're not really what the show is about. They're more about the reaction to these aliens. So you don't know whether, like, the 4, 5, 6 are an alien government that are doing this. You don't know if the single 4, 5, 6 representative who is in the room is actually an ambassador, if he's speaking on behalf of a species that has made a decision. You don't know whether he's a businessman who's decided to, like, go from, as spoiler for what we discover they're using the children for, from, like, you know, using drugs to selling drugs. I love that all this stuff is left ambiguous and it's never really defined, and so it becomes kind of scarier because you're put in the position of, humanity confronted with this thing, where in Doctor Who, the Doctor will always, like, monologue and explain things. And maybe not literally. Maybe he won't literally explain what a thing is, but he'll explain through metaphor what it is. Yeah. And so you can kind of get it and follow it. Here, you're dropped into a story where it's just like, no, this thing just does that. It just screams every once in a while. It just vomits green stuff every once in a while. It has three heads, and I don't know if those three heads have three separate brains.
I think they're tails. Yeah. They look like... Okay. The 456 just looks like three giant scorpion tails with a weird connection tube wire to attach to children.
Yeah. Okay, and this is what's great. I mean, yeah. I think what's most interesting, you said, it's the fact that I know it could be one alien playing a big con, and that's what it could be, or it could be a fleet of like 10,000 456 about to rain havoc on Earth. You know, and what I kind of find like, I'm particularly interested in getting later on as well, and we'll come on to that, is that there's no real question of like, what is going on? Who are they? What do they really know? Yeah. That's the scary thing, is the reaction or the lack of reaction to the 456. And that's the scariest part for me more than that. Actually, the 456, they look kind of terrifying because they're so unknown, and everything you see is quite creepy and mysterious. Like, brilliant way of, doing it through screens, having lots of mist. You don't need an explanation, really. Yeah. And you don't need to see a lot of them. You don't need to see what a full 5-6. It probably will look pretty naff, potentially. It could be the Murker.
Yeah.
But who knows? But it's great. It's great. They look perfect for the part. And you're right. Simon Poland's voice, I think, is fantastic.
Warriors of the Deep recontextualized now, boys.
There you go. I've blown it wide open.
There's the redemption story you're waiting for.
I do really like the voice. He's kind of, he gives it like Gabriel Wolf vibes. Mm. Like super.
Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah.
He's like the spiritual successor.
Yeah. Oh, very much so, yeah.
And like, again, not to get too like into talking about later episodes or whatever, but like the thing about the 456 is that they are malicious and malevolent. Like, all the choices they make, like, again, if you're, and again, part of me loves that this is just how Davies scripts this stuff, where people critique Davies as a writer for not necessarily being obsessed with plot holes or whatever, for not being obsessed with order type plotting, where people like ask questions about like, oh, well, there are obvious logical plot gaps with these earlier scripts he wrote or whatever. You know, like, he's not concerned with delivering exposition to explain the techno babble. He just sticks it in and assumes that you'll get from context because he understands the emotional heart of the story is more important. And I love that early on you have like Frobisher ask, well, look, if they can communicate to us through this radio frequency 456, that's what they get their name from, why are they talking through the children? Like, if they can just have a hotline to us, why would they choose to make an announcement through the children? And Decker's like, to scare us. Like, the entire point of this is to terrify the human species. And I love that so much of their performance is like petty and vindictive and mean-spirited, where, like, they seem, they're not just doing this thing, they seem to kind of get off on the fact that they have enough power to manipulate mankind to do these terrible things for them. So they don't, for example, gather the children up themselves. They demand that the children are brought to them. Don't know why they, you know, maybe they could stage mass abductions. If they can get children to say things, they could probably get children to walk to particular places and just take them. But for them, it seems to be part of the thrill is getting humanity to debase themselves. That moment at the end of the fourth episode where, like, after Jack has done his terrible last stand and after the ambassador has released the virus to kill everybody in Them's house, he's like, you said you would fight. Which is just very much like, I'm not only have I won, and not only do I know that I've won, and not only do I know that you're going to capitulate, I just want you to know you said you would fight and you are not doing it. You're a coward. You failed completely. The moment where like Frobisher like responds with the offer, I think at the start of, is it episode 4, where he's like, look, we can give you, is it something like 6,000 kids or 6,800 kids or whatever it is? And the ambassador waits a moment and then responds with, you know, he goes 6,800. That's what we can do. And the ambassador then replies with, no, I said, and then makes the children say 10% of each population of each country. Yeah. Like, there is a malevolence there. And even things like the idea that like they don't hide what they're using the children for. Like they don't lie. They're not like, oh well, we're using the children. We want to take them away to a magical place where they will be free of this suffering on Earth. Like we want to take them to a planet that isn't suffering global warming. So yeah, we want to take them to Neverland or something like that. You know, your planet is going to collapse. We want to take these kids away and give them a better life. It's like, no, we want to hook ourselves up to them. And like when they're like, so do you use them to survive? Are they necessary for you guys to live? The 456 is like, no, we just use them for the hit. We use them to get high. They make us feel good. And it's like, there seems to be an element of them because they are smart enough. They're like, they understand. They understand social norms and they understand humanity. There's a moment where Frobisher, before he, like when they do the initial meeting, before they let the Americans in, Frobisher is like, just so we're clear on this. Nobody needs to know that you were here in 1965, right? That's agreed, right? You understand that. And the ambassador's like, yeah, I understand that. And then the moment that Frobisher starts to get just a little bit too big for his britches, the ambassador's like, by the way, for the Americans watching, I just want you all to know we talked to the British before this, yeah. And we want to make this as uncomfortable as possible for everybody. Like, the 456 understand what they're doing, which I think makes what they're doing so terrifying. Yeah. Like they could sell a lie that would be more comforting, but it seems like they enjoy the fact that humanity can't hide behind lies. They like the fact that they're being honest about what they're using the children for. They like the fact that they have this power, which is really horrifying. It makes them more monstrous than aliens who get high off children like should be, and that's pretty monstrous.
I just get the vibes. They're also just having a bit of fun with it. They are. Just in their voice, it just sounds like they're like, well, we can do this. Why not have fun with it? You know, really smug, like, we want them for drugs. What are you going to do about it?
Well, exactly. I'm not even sure that actually they can do what they can say. I actually believe that it's like, we can get away with this. I kind of always read it as a con. You know, they might be a little bit damaged, but they couldn't wipe out mankind, maybe in the way they say. But they've got enough power, enough kind of twisted evil charisma to go, we can get away with this, and we can be so openly blunt with you that you will do what we say.
And they have to kind of believe this as well, because like Jack's like, well, we need to fight them, but like if the Doctor was there, he'd be like, well, you say that, but but the government's like, oh God, we best give them kids, and Jack's like, we just need to stop this.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're like this. Again, the point of comparison here is, and I think it's quite intentional, I think Davies knows what he's doing, is something like the Christmas Invasion, where the Sycorax show up and they, like, get people to walk to the edge of, like, these things and threaten to kill them off unless mankind gives away a certain percentage of their population as slaves. And, you know, obviously the end of that episode is the blood magic doesn't work. It can't get them to hurt them. So the Doctor pushes the big red button and nothing happens and the Sycorax were just bluffing. So I think that this is written with that in mind. So it's assuming that if you are a Doctor Who fan, if you are familiar with the franchise and how Davies writes the franchise, there is at least part of you that is thinking what Baz said there, which is that this is just one big bluff from the 456. That if you say no to them, they might release a virus, they might not release a virus, they may just bugger off. And like that's the thing where it's like, if you comply with these demands that they make, they've shown that they're not gonna just like bugger off and never bother you again. They came with, for, you know, what was 11 children, 12 children, one of whom didn't go in 1965. They came back in 2009, and if you give them 10% of the world's children in 2009... how are you not assuming that they're going to come back again and demand as much or more the next time?
Yeah.
I love that the show kind of leaves all these lingering questions unanswered, because again, it's the urgency of this is five nights. Yeah. This is happening immediately and viscerally. There's no chance to think about it.
I also like how, I think you see it in flashback to start of episode four. Before as well, 456 gave them something in return. It was like the cure to influenza or whatever it was. Yeah. And Jack's like, 12 children for the cure? Yeah, seems fair. And here they're like, what, you want something from us? No, we're just going to take your kids. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
I mean, so yeah, we obviously got the arrival of the US military and unit in the role, who aren't particularly effectual in this story, which is interesting. But then you get the, obviously, Lois takes on the tortured contact lenses, and you get the negotiations. So that I mean, that whole kind of final scene when everyone tortured, and the US and unit and the government are all watching Phobos negotiation with the 456 is pretty intense.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. And again, this is Davies. Davies has always been this very angry political writer. He's been this very active political writer who has very strong views about politics, and particularly about Britain, and particularly about like Britain's relationship with the US. And I love that, like, obviously that plays out. You would have talked about the first season. You would have talked about things like World War III and Aliens of London, for example. Obviously, it plays out again with Harold Saxon playing not Tony Blair, we swear. But here, like, you have this idea of, and it's something that Davies plays out repeatedly. It played out, I think, in The Sound of Drums, where you have this idea of the relationship between the US and Britain, particularly at that moment in time in the wake of the Iraq War, and how Davies sees that, which is this idea that, like, Britain sees itself, again, it's this really cynical worldview where Britain sees itself as a world power. Britain presumes to negotiate on the part of the world, but what really happens is the Americans just wade in and tell them how it's meant to be done, which again is a very, very angry political slant to have in 2009. Again, this is post Blair and Bush. This is post Iraq War. And I think Davies is coming at it from that angle. But I do love that you have a situation where, as cynical as Children of Earth is about the British government, it's also like contemptuous of their inefficiency.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Like, this is a show that thinks the British government is awful, but is also like, the British government are also inept at being awful. Where, like, the Americans have to show up and have to intervene and have to take charge. And I love at the end that you have the moment where Green is like, oh, nice that the Americans came in and took charge, because then we can claim that it wasn't our idea at all.
Oh, it's so awful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially as, like, he's also, like, throughout pretty much all of this, he's just like, Frobisher, yeah, John, you're just the middleman. Like, I can pin this all on you if I want.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I see. Green is such a whole character. But, of course, when you get to episode 4 then, and you get that Cobra meeting, my God, just the most... I think it's the point where, you know, you get into episode 4 then, you know they want 10% of the children, and there's a lot we'll talk about in episode 4, but I think the Cobra meeting is probably the most chilling piece
terrifying of
TV drama. Watching it, you're watching it with your mouth hanging open, and what's even scarier now is you think if Davies was basically taking a dig at the government at the time... You talk about these Suella Bravermans and the Priti Patels and all the people of current government, you think, my God, what would they be like in this kind of situation as well? And it feels even more terrifying now when you look at what's happened in that scene.
Yeah, like these days, I think, my mum said, like, it could have been you, but said, oh yeah, these days, they just go, yeah, have all the kids from Rwanda.
Quite possibly.
Yeah. We're not going to give you bits from every country.
But that's exactly what, one of the parts of this that has aged really well is that the first thing that they suggest is, like, when they go into the meeting and they start calling children units, the first thing that Frobisher applies, the first logic that Frobisher applies is we have it's something like 40 or, you know, 20 or 40 unattended minors seeking asylum.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the first offering that we make. It's like they're not our children, quote unquote, yes. So they are expendable. And I love that it happens. Like, the thing about that scene is the most horrifying scene in the miniseries, but it happens so quickly.
Yeah.
And it happens with no resistance whatsoever. Like, there's a sense in that meeting room that everybody is just looking for an excuse to make the decision. Like, they're just waiting for somebody else to say something that will make it all right for them to kind of jump along. And maybe they might nudge it further, but nobody is going to push back. Like that. That's the thing. There's the moment where they go, well, you know, the moment we've decided that nobody's children or grandchildren in this room is eligible for the lottery, then the whole idea of random selection goes out the window. And you're like, no, like, yes, it's bad that you are exempting your own children from it. But the fact that you exempted your own children from it doesn't immediately mean that any randomness whatsoever is completely out the window. But the fact that they are able to make that leap so quickly in the space of three or four lines.
It is. It's terrifying.
And it's so believable. It's sold so, so well. And again, that really terrible, awful. And I say terrible, awful line. I mean, a great line, but really unsettling, nightmarish line, where it's like, if we can't identify the bottom 10% performing schools in this country, then what are league tables for?
I know.
And it's like, Jesus. Yeah.
It's horrific, and yet you can imagine that being said. It's, I mean, the language is really interesting. You start with, let's talk figures. Can you bump the figures up to 60? And then they start to refer to them as units. We need 10% of children or units in the country. And, you know, what would a reduction help? You know, what would it, you know? And then trying to spin it as well. I mean, you think Nick Briggs' character in it. Nick Briggs, utter shit as well. You know.
Yeah.
Could we spin it's a reduction in children would help with the resources of
the Thanos country. Argument. Yeah,
the Thanos argument. As it builds and builds and builds, and I think Deborah Finley as Denise Reilly, my God, she's the one that says the league table line. And it's that kind of almost glint in her eye when she says, what about the failing schools? What about them? The ones that are of not, you know, benefits, you know, people who are less socially useful, they're on benefits and pensions.
Going to clog up our street corners and, you know, juvenile detention prisons. Yeah. Well, I mean, like, and again, like, it's worth noting that, like, again, she does come out the worst of this. She's like, Frobisher is a civil servant. Again, that description Decker has as the cockroaches of government, where these people who just survive and implement these policies. Again, that banality of evil thing, the question of, like, is the civil service as bad or worse than the politicians making these choices because the civil service just does it without thinking? It does it without any resistance or any morality. But the idea that the worst person in that room is Reilly, but it's something that I think, and again, maybe I'm generalizing, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it's something interesting that, like, Davies comes back to repeatedly, where you have these middle-aged, middle-class women tend to be, like, the worst people in the world in Davies' scripts. So you go to, like, Midnight, for example. The person on that ship, on that shuttle, who pushes, like, the situation to breaking point, who, like, drives the passengers to turn on the doctor, is the mother of this middle-class family. And it's kind of interesting that you get to Children of Earth, which is, I would argue, something of a companion piece to that, and Turn Left. And it's like, the person in the room who immediately pushes the conversation in that direction is this, you know, very middle upper class kind of family woman, which is kind of interesting.
In Years and Years, that's kind of like who the Prime Minister is well, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's very Thatcher-esque, actually, now that you mention it, now that you put it in that context.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, the Thatchers of the world. So, RTD just hates Prime Ministers. Like, I mean, no, seriously, like, we've seen filming for Series 14, we've seen this, like, sort of political candidate guy, he's not going to be painted well.
No, he's not, is he? So, what about the stuff with Jack then, Ben? So, obviously, we've got the revelation in the part three that Jack was there in 1965 with Clement. So, what do you think of Clement's reaction when he shoots Jack and the kind of the whole betrayal as Jack comes to life?
I mean, it's understandable. Yeah. Like, this guy just basically took you from orphanage and went, right, go into the light, go to heaven.
Yeah.
Well, it says we're going on an, like, the worst part is, like, the lies that Jack tells the kids, which is, like, it's going on an adventure and you don't want to miss out, I think is one of the lines he says.
We're going on a trip in our favourite rocket ship.
Yeah. And what at this point, you haven't actually found out what they're using the kids for yet. You had that scene when you find the kid and the thing. So
I think you see that scene in this, but I don't think they out and out say for the hit until episode 5.
Yeah, no, yeah.
It's day 5 where you learn just why it's, like, lashed up and stuff.
So and like, crucially to a unit, like, officer, to, like, and again, part of the perversion of it is that you have, like, unit at the edge of the story, and unit is, like, the most Doctor Who element of this, where they're the guys who are, like, the Brigadier, and they're the guys who are just, like, nice people who do good things. And it's the fact that, like, when the British government so fucks up at the end of episode 4 that the Americans take charge, you have the unit representative is the one who's in the room.
Yeah.
And it's the unit representative who gets the for the hit. Like, that, it's not just they're explaining it to Frobisher or they're explaining it to Green. It's they're explaining it to this character who is closely tied to what is effectively a family TV show, who's wearing a uniform from the family TV show with the unit ident on it. There's something very interesting and very kind of subversive in that, I think.
Very much.
There's no wonder they brought Kate Stewart in to clear up unit after that. Well. I think, to be fair, the Grand Serpent going through the years of unit saw this happen and went, you know what, I'm just going to let them do that one on their own. I'm just going to go skip ahead to Kate Stewart.
Don't talk about the Grand Serpent and unit.
Oh, it hurts you.
Yeah, it does.
Really, I remember watching the episode and it was like,
what are you doing? What are you doing? Anyway. Obviously, we get a lot of the, obviously, where's the code meeting? We've got the continued negotiations with the 456. I mean, what do you think of the scenes then when the soldier goes into the tank and we see that child for the first time?
That's a very, very horror movie. Like, you've written here very xenomorph.
And, yes. Yeah.
It's like, oh, there's this child just hooked up and stuff going through the gas. And, like, it's like this space warfield or something.
It's horrific.
Just corpses everywhere.
And again, like this, and again, part of me is like, I mean, Ben mentioned Neverland earlier. There is this weird element where, like, Jack is this immortal figure, and part of the tragedy of Torchwood, part of the tragedy of Jack, and part of the tragedy of, like, Children of Earth when you get to the final scene is this idea that Jack is the survivor who outlives everything. But this idea that these children, who were taken in 1965, are, like, alive. And you don't, yeah. You don't, like, they haven't grown, they haven't matured, they're still small bodies. Their eyes are open. We don't know whether or not their brains are functioning or whatever, but they are surviving. And it's kind of monstrous and it's horrific. And it does tie back into that idea of Jack as this survivor. Again, this idea that Davies has that recurs throughout his work, like the Doctor surviving the destruction of Gallifrey, for example. Jack outliving absolutely everybody in his life. And this kind of monstrous idea that the children are alive in there. And like you even have like Decker describing the chemical composition of like the gas, and it's like, sure, the children are wearing masks on the back of the 456, presumably to keep it alive, but their skin and their eyes are still exposed to this, like, and presumably have been for the past 44 years.
Yeah, well, Decker's just like basically poison.
Oh,
it's like,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
It is. And yeah. Again, which goes back when you, and the fact that they continue to have that debate. I mean, that, I think because it's like, yeah. If there's a few scenes with the Cobra meetings, we've talked about them all, but yeah, I think the stuff with the league schools and the 10%, you know, and what the lowest performing children are the ones being taken, that comes off the back of that scene. So they've seen what happens to the children, and it's like, there's no, you've already established early on, as you said, Ben. They gave them a cure for influenza. So great, they saved. And you know, if you look at a numbers game, if you detach yourself from the, in a way, you could go, they sacrificed 11 children to save millions. And you can almost understand, as horrific as it is, Jack making that decision, not knowing what's going to happen to the children. Now they've seen this and they're going to sacrifice millions of children.
Yeah, and it's like when that woman tells Jack,
we would like a gift.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, when Jack's like, oh, and you picked me because I can't die? No, we just wanted someone who wouldn't care. It's like, okay,
yeah,
fine.
Yeah, which is a lot about his character too.
There's also, with this, there's a comic where, like, the villain's pretending to be a Time Lord impersonating them in a big con thing, and at the end, the 11th Doctor turns him back into a child, which is already quite horrific, and then zaps him with the sonic screwdriver as he's trying to leave with the Vortex Manipulator, and he ends up, like, unable to speak, and he ends up there in 1965, where they're like, oh, well, now we have 12 children. And it's... leave it ambiguous as to whether this was an accident or the Doctor deliberately did this.
Wow.
You don't actually know. And if so, 11's blown 7 out of the water there and stuff.
That's like, horrific.
The Doctor might know about the 456, or this might just be the worst accident of all time.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay. He just tried to scam some bird people by pretending to be a Time Lord. It's like, like he did anything horrific.
Yeah. That's horrific.
It is.
And again, like, it just to center and foreground this. Like, the theme of this is the idea of sacrificing children for the security of mankind or the safety of mankind, which is a very pointed bit of political commentary in any number of ways. Like, we're living in a, you know, a world where climate change means that our children are probably not going to have the same world that we have, and we are choosing our own comfort and convenience over that as well. And again, things like, more basically, the funding of schools and stuff like that, the funding of, like, paying of teachers' salaries and stuff like that, that, again, punish children so that, like, adults can have tax breaks and various other things, which again is very pointed, very political, very angry. What I find interesting about this, and again, this is one of those things where this exists at the cusp of the end of the Davies era. The Moffat era is a year away at this point, roughly, right? It's this idea that the sacrifice of children, and again, maybe this is something to talk about with episode 5, with how the story actually resolves itself, but I find it interesting that Davies and Moffat are both separately interested in this idea of the sacrifice of children and the question of, like, what is how humanity would respond to that, how people respond to that, and Davies is kind of very cynical about it, whereas Moffat is in some cases more optimistic, at least in terms of how he ends his stories. But that's to put a pin in when we talk about episode 5.
Yeah, of course. So before we get to episode 5 then, let's talk about the Thames House scene. So we've had, as you said, Lois stands up. It's that triumphant moment. Lois stands up the government. Jack and Yanta go in. You think, right, we're going to turn the tables now. And then, holy crap, they just... I mean, it's talk about bleak endings.
It just, like, snaps and they're like, oh, God. But the really sad thing with Yanto as well is, like, Jack's, like, running to, oh, God, come get out. Like, I can survive this, but Yanto can't. Oh, God. And Yanto probably knows that in his head, but he's still there holding the gun, like, stop this or we will shoot.
Yeah.
He knows he's, like, and then, like, just grabbing on to Jack and just, like, in 1,000 years, just don't forget me.
And the fact that, like, it's bulletproof, like, the fact that their plan consists of walking into Thames House and pointing a gun at an alien in a case that was presumably built by humanity to specifications that included bulletproof glass.
Yeah.
Like again, part of me loves that the series, like, the episode commits to it, where you get the theme ramping up, you get the cross-cutting, you get the triumphant moment, you get you and what army? Torchwood. And it's like, boom, gotcha.
Yeah.
But I love that, like, Jack's plan, which admittedly entirely on the fly, consisted of largely walking into Thames House and giving, again, his crap poor version of a doctor speech. And again, Ianto kind of calls him out on it, where it's like, you know, that I like the philosophy, you know, where it's like an injury to one is an injury to all, which is kind of what you imagine, like, a doctor resolution to this might be, yeah. But in the Davies era, it comes with the backup of, oh, and in case that doesn't work, genocide. Now, in case that doesn't work, your entire species is dead. Whereas, like, again, you can point at something like, say, school reunion, for example, where the doctor gives that big speech, that big one warning, the bit of, like, the Christmas invasion, the no second chances. Whereas in the Davies era, it's like, you give that speech.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The alien refuses to learn its lesson, and then the doctor has to take harsh action and punish it for that. In the Moffat era, you tend to have the doctor gives that one big speech and either it backfires spectacularly and the doctor suffers terribly for it, as at, like, in the Pandorica opens, for example, or the doctor gives that big speech and the alien is so moved that they either run away, like at the end of the 11th hour, or they make peace as they do at the end of, like, the Zygon inversion. And I love that, like, this is Jack as, like, the crappy version of the doctor being like, I can just walk in and bluster my way through this situation. I can, like, deliver a stirring, like, speech that will tug at the heartstrings of this alien while also proving that humanity is indomitable, and then doesn't. It just doesn't work.
The only useful thing they get out of this at all is
yeah.
the Johnson is not pursuing Torchwood anymore. Like, she kind of joins him. That is the only thing. Like, Gwen's like, oh, we've got this on tape. And Reese is just, like, sat there on the bench, ready to press play. He has no idea Yondu's dying.
Well, that's it. You've got to get your... You've got Gwen about blackmailing Johnson. Like, if you don't stop, Reese is going to release everything what the government has said to the world. It's like, it's supposed to be the moment of triumph, and then you just see Gwen just watching the screens going, what do I do? And then Clement dies now next to her because they punish him as well. It's horrific.
Can we, like, again, it's one of the things I do love about this show, and rewatching it, like, one episode after another, kind of in a binge mode, is that, like, everything in this show fails. Like, everything in this show, up until the last possible minute, goes horribly, horribly wrong because people vastly overestimate, like, their ability to deal with problems. Where, like, for example, like, the entire motivating arc of, like, episode one or day one and day two of the show is that Frobisher has put out the kill order on Torchwood because he wants to cover up the United Kingdom's involvement in this human trafficking case. That he wants to cover up, he wants to prevent the world from finding out, or the Americans or foreign governments from finding out that Britain traded with these aliens before. That's the sole motivation. And so you get two whole episodes of the team being literally blown apart, murdered, and, like, hunted and chased down. And then it's just ruined by a throwaway line of dialogue from the 4-5-6. Like, the 4-5-6 is just like, well, screw that. I'm throwing a temper tantrum now. I'm just exerting my power, and I'm going to draw attention to the fact that we have been here before and we have dealt with you before, and that's your problem to deal with. So Frobisher's big plan to wipe out Torchwood, the blank page protocol, is that what he calls it?
Yes.
Amounts to nothing. And I love that, like, same thing with that big stand up to the aliens. It amounts to nothing. I think, like, Ben mentioned, the one thing that you get is you get, like, you know, the kind of Johnson kind of switching sides. You do also get, yeah, Clem dying and that becoming kind of plot relevant, where they figure out that they can turn the signal back from the fact that Clem died. But it's still this incredible, like, failure. And I love that the episode doesn't end with the failure. Like, the failure happens at the end of, I think, like, the penultimate act, but you get a whole act of episode four or day four where the characters just kind of sit in that failure before day five begins. It isn't a cliffhanger. It isn't like Jack is holding Ianto's body and we just cut to black. It's like, no, there are bodies.
Yeah.
Like, we see all the bodies from Them's house being kind of fished out.
Yeah, the bodies in the sports hall is pretty... That's the kind of the ending, isn't it? You know, when you...
Yeah.
The heroes have lost hope, and as an audience, you're like, how is this going to get resolved? Because, you know, you've had a massacre now. Ianto, one of the pivotal characters of the show, has died, and they're just...
And Gwen, it's not even the finale.
And Gwen and Jack there with Ianto and all of their bodies going, what do we do now?
100 years since Nosferatu first terrified audiences on the big screen.
30 years since Francis Ford Coppola gave us Bram Stoker's Dracula.
And 10 years since Dark Shadows with Johnny Depp.
Vampire Videos is a podcast taking a look at this iconic blood-sucking monster on film and television.
I'm Dan Owen.
And I'm Hugh McStay.
And we're here to guide you through a century of vampirism on film. From Hollywood's golden age with Bela Lugosi as Count Dracula,
to the more lurid Hammer horrors of the 60s and 70s starring Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee,
through to the 80s boom in vampires, which brought these creatures of the night into the modern age.
And everything this century's had to offer us, from foreign and independent films, spoof comedies, and even teenage love stories. Yes, I'm talking about Twilight.
We aim to cover it all, one bite at a time.
So join us on a voyage into the depths of vampire cinema, old and new, with weekly guests offering their own insights and expertise. And why not follow us on Twitter, @VampVideos.
A proud part of the We Made This podcast network, subscribe now to Vampire Videos, and thanks for listening.
I remember some point last year, just seeing somewhere on Twitter, someone saying, like, Children of Earth is, like, the perfect deconstruction of why Torchwood as a team is fundamentally useless. it just doesn't work to do this. And then it just goes, yeah, no.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if this was Doctor Who, the blue box would materialise in the room, he'd step out, just snap his fingers, and 4-5-6 would go away.
Well, but
here, they just put a gun in it, and it's like, you what?
Well, exactly.
You want to go.
The climax to episode four feels like it's playing at the climax of Doctor Who episode, and then it doesn't work. And then you get episode five with Gwen's open narration of this is how the world ended. I mean, what do you think of that opening speech?
I mean, it's really bleak, but I also really like it because, like, not only does it establish, like, everything's gone to hell, but also why might the Doctor not be coming to help with this? Like,
yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to thought of, you know, the humanity is so compromised why would the Doctor help them? It's an interesting twist on the idea that Doctors always thought of humans as good.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting how, like, pretty much for all of this episode, Jack's just sat in the cell like, oh, okay, I don't know what to do. Like, because I think he says to Frobisher, like, okay, fine, arrest me, but just let Gwen go back, tell Yanto's family, and just do what you want. And even when they're coming to, like, get him out of the cell to help, like, change the frequency, he's kind of like, what's the point?
Yeah, it's completely lost. Yeah. Everyone's kind of lost faith at this point.
Gwen and Reese, they're, like, the only two with faith left.
And he literally comes down to trying to save a handful of children.
That's it.
It's not like trying to save the world, it's literally trying to save some children, and that's what it comes down to.
Intercut with those scenes of the children being pushed onto the buses and the parents screaming.
Well, absolutely, yes.
And beautifully shot as well. Shot kind of like with handheld footage, sort of evokes like 28 Days Later, for example.
Very much so, yeah.
It's very, very, very well done. Like, Euros Lynn's direction is really great on these episodes, I think.
Yeah. Before we talk about those scenes then with the kids as well, a couple of things I want to talk about. Obviously, you mentioned this is the point where we find out what they actually want the kids for, basically as drugs. And then you get that scene with Frobisher and Green when Green tells them the kids have been selected to help the media cover over the inoculations.
Yeah, what about the anti-vaxxers? What are they going to go for?
I did wonder that.
That is something that has aged interestingly with regards to this series, where it's like, part of it, I was watching it and I was writing down, is the show anti-vax question mark? Because this is the year in which we live. Obviously it is not.
Yes.
But I do love that it's very much like it taps into that conspiracy theory mindset where, like, if the government is trying to lie to you, vaccines are a thing that the government forces you and children to get. And therefore, if they were going to do it, that would be the way that they would do it. And part of me is like, if Davies were writing this today, what would he come up with apart from we're going to call it immunization or vaccination?
Yeah, it would not be vaccines today because there's too many people who would just go.
And that, again, that's kind of a true aspect to this. You're right, it would be done different today. The fact that you got the reference to the World Health Organization, which, to be honest, a lot of people didn't even know about pre-COVID, and now it's like very much there, and you're like, oh, God, this is terrifying.
You know what this means?
Part of me is also like it was a joke. Part of me is like that thing where Peter Capaldi, like, plays Who Doctor in, like, World War Z before he plays the 12th Doctor. And part of me is like, when they reference the World Health Organization, I'm like, you mean the doctors at WHO?
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
I remember seeing, like, somewhere 2020, just a tweet saying, like, because I think, like, old doctors from the World Health Organization came together to try and help with COVID vaccine, but someone, like, posted that caption and then just put a picture of the five doctors. All doctors from WHO are here to help.
Yeah.
It's interesting, like, how, in a way, the Doctor is here with Capaldi, but this is pre-Doctor.
Yes, definitely not Doctor.
The two sides of Frobisher, you either get this Frobisher, who's just stuck in the middle with everything, he doesn't want to know what to do, or you get the shape-changing Penguin.
They are both two sides of the same coin. Like, I mean, Frobisher is such a great character because, and again, it's because Capaldi plays him. He's obviously, like, riffing off the character from, like, The Thick of It.
Yes.
I can't remember the name. Malcolm Tucker, that's who it is. Where Tucker is this force of nature who, like, works through government and just makes government work through sheer force of will. He's this almost, like, this heroic figure who comes in, sorts out all of your problems, and maybe manages to somehow make government work in some small, quantifiable way.
Yeah,
whilst wearing his head off.
Well, yeah, whilst wearing his hair. But he's a force of nature. He sweeps in, he comes in, he takes charge, and he shows these, like, elected officials how to do their jobs. And Frobisher is like the anti that, where obviously he's very quiet, he's very introverted, he's very withdrawn. I do love the implication that even though he obviously loves his daughters and his wife, he's apparently, like, had affairs. Like, I think there's the implication that he had an affair with Bridget Spears years ago when she has, like, that conversation with Lois where she's like, don't think you're the first. Don't go thinking you're the first. But this idea of, like, he does feel some sense of moral indignation with what he's doing. Like, his reaction shots in those Cobra briefing scenes are fantastic because you can see him reacting to what's being said. Now, obviously, he is such a good civil servant, a cockroach of government, to quote Decker, that he doesn't voice any objection. But the moments when those ideas come up and you get these quick flashes of his unveiled reaction to the suggestions the Prime Minister's making, are very, very interesting. And again, that moment where Green is... Sorry, I almost called him Brown. I don't know why I almost called the Prime Minister in this Brown. But the Prime Minister Green, the moment where he has that meeting with Frobisher and he's like, I'm sorry, John. I'm very sorry. I'm also very busy. Mm. It's such an awful human being. He is so spectacularly terrible that it is something to behold. And you're almost like, is Frobisher a good person by comparison? Like, this person who seemed, yeah.
The fact that the next Frobisher is his final scene, the fact that when he finally takes action is the scene when he takes his family into the bedroom and shoots and kills them all to save them from the 456.
Just because Green's like, oh, yeah, by the way, I said everyone was going to be exempt, but, you know, you're the middleman. If you offer your kids up, it'll look good for us. And Frobisher's face is just like, what? No.
I mean, it's obviously hugely tragic, because if he'd waited 4 hours later, it would have been fine. But it's almost seen as bizarrely heroic at the same time. The fact that he's saving his children from this life of eternal torment, what have you seen with these kids, you know, drugged up kids, that by actually killing his kids, and obviously I assume because his wife at the same time, because he can't put more for the
there's four
pain.
Shots so yeah, four, be yeah so he kills his wife and himself.
There's the three shots and then the pause, which, like, it's the pause that gets me every time. It's, like, it's the bit where you hear three quick shots and then a moment and then the final shot as the camera pulls back from the closed door.
It's really bleak and powerful stuff, but It's kind of almost bizarrely framed as a mercy. It's the fact that he's almost saving his family by killing them, because there are worse people out there.
I mean, if you compare the scenarios, killing them or letting them be as the drugs, it is the merciful situation here.
Yeah.
But, like, that's the thing about, like, Children of Earth, which is so terrifying.
Yeah.
It's like, and again, it's that moment at the end of episode 4 where, like, you have Jack give this big doctor speech, which is an injury to one is an injury to all. And again, this is something Davies is very fond of. Like, I think in Utopia, you have the moment where, like, the 10th doctor repeats the 4th doctor's, this is what I love about humanity. They're indomitable, indomitable. And then the very next episode, or the episode after the very next episode, reveals that actually all these indomitable human beings who had been shipped off to Utopia are now, like, murderous chocolophane. Mm. They're, like, the worst aspects of anything that ever existed. Here you have the idea of Jack being like, no, humanity will stand back and humanity will fight. And you have the 456 again mockingly saying, you said you would fight. But the idea that, like, as soon as that pressure is applied, even Jack cradling Ianto's body is like, I take it back. Just save him. I take it back. I didn't mean anything I said. He capitulates almost immediately as soon as something he loves is taken from him. He loses any will to fight whatsoever. You mentioned the fact that even here, he's in the prison cell and he has to be, like, Johnson ends up saving the day, which is something I think we could maybe talk about in a moment, because Johnson is fascinating as a character. But you have, like, with Frobisher, there's this thing where there's no sense of anything, but he cannot imagine fighting this. He cannot imagine resisting this. He cannot imagine doing comparable to what they're doing on the council estates. He can't imagine resisting the government. He can't imagine a world where he doesn't enact the will. He's again, that perfect civil servant, that banality of evil, to get back to, at the risk of evoking, like, Nazism. But the idea of the people who implement this policy being, like, boring pencil pushers with, you know, glasses on, who just make these decisions in cold and calculated ways. Like, there's the moment at the start of episode 4, I think it is, which is very fascinating, where Green keeps trying to punt responsibility onto Frobisher. Yeah. And Frobisher takes a lot of it, to be fair. But there's a moment where Green is like, so John, how would we do this? And Frobisher, like, in his one moment of pushing back, is like, well, we would not be involved in the decisions about the selection of the children. But once that decision is made, we could arrange for transport and delivery. And it's like, it's very interesting that you have this. Frobisher cannot imagine a world where he, as a functionary, could ever push back against a decision made by the government. That he could never not enact a decision made by the government. So the only choice he has when he gets to episode 4 isn't one of resistance, it's one of negation.
Yeah.
He can't tell his wife to run away with the children. He can't leak the information to the press and hope to start some sort of public revolt that would maybe prevent it from happening. He can't, you know, do anything with anybody. He can't do what Johnson does and get Torchwood back together to try and enact a plan to stop the aliens. His brain just doesn't work like that. His only option is, I can remove these quote-unquote units from consideration. I can take them off the board. And that's, like, possibly the darkest and most cynical thing at the heart of like Children of Earth, is this idea that when you present human beings with these terrible, horrible situations, we normalize them very, very quickly. We accept them very, very quickly. And we internalize them and go along with them very quickly. We don't, you know, we don't fight back. The idea that we will fight back in response to tyranny is often a romantic fantasy.
Oh, I think you see a lot of the reflection. We've talked about it, we'll put it a bit briefly. You know, the scenes with the kids being rounded up and the mother screaming Christopher and just Gren and Reese and Rhiannon running with the children. It's really harrowing stuff at this point. But it's kind of what it's been building to.
Yeah, especially as you've got they're coming and they just run across the field. They're being jumped on. That one kid who's hiding just being scooped up and taken.
Yeah. I mean, these are, you know, this is kind of like almost like Holocaust ghetto imagery here as well. Yeah. It's really, really gritty, powerful, horrible stuff. I mean, you saw a little bit of that in Turn Left Again, and you kind of seeing it realised here, and not being an alternate reality, being something actually happens is just horrifying. Yeah. So the scenes with Jack Johnson, Deckard, and Alison, again, they're equally as harrowing. I think Deckard in this is a real particularly nasty piece of work in these scenes.
Yeah, it occurred to me the other day, I was just looking on the TARDIS wiki and stuff, and I saw a picture of Zelin from Can You Hear Me? And I was like, you know what? I know that face. I'm trying to remember who it was. And then I realised he also was Deckard, and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it's that moment as well, you know, when the realisation of what they can actually do just to sort the 556 is sending that message back, and it's his glee when he says that Jack has a child and that child is going to fry, and you know exactly what Charlie is talking about. You know, Jack knows what the order is about. It's that kind of gleeful smile as he builds up to kind of Jack's kind of impossible choice as well.
One child or millions.
Well, the fact that he survives like the attack on Them's House, again, that cockroach of government is how he describes the civil service. But the bit where it's like the unit operative is like, so how did you manage to survive? It's like, I just stood back, sir. It's a strategy that like I've been doing it all my life. I didn't. That's the inverse of the kind of like counterpoint to Frobisher. That story that, you know, that is it Susan tells about Frobisher, where it's like he just kept his head down. He didn't do anything. He didn't push ahead. He just kept his head down, did what he was supposed to do. He didn't push forward. He didn't try and run. He didn't try to get ahead. He just endured. And like, there is something monstrous in this idea of Decker as somebody who is like such a functionary of the state that he just survives. He just endures. Even here, like, he gets shot in the leg, which is very satisfying.
Very satisfying.
But he still ends up, like, one of the few characters to get out of this more or less intact.
So, Ben, what do you think of the scenes, then, with the sacrifice of his grandson?
Well, yeah, it's not very fun, is it? Like, Alice banging on the window while Jack goes and Steve's like, what's going on? And then suddenly he starts doing a John Sim from the End of Time.
Yeah, it's as harrowing as anything we've had. I mean, but I guess by this point, we shouldn't really be surprised that, you know, the show is going this dark.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is, like, again, this is, to bring it back to Davies, because this is your retrospective. You're looking at Davies' career on Doctor Who. It's very telling that, like, Jack ends up doing, and again, this is the thing with Davies, where Davies arguably has a very cynical view of human nature, particularly when you contrast it to Moffat's work on Doctor Who, where everybody lives, or Moffat's work, which is, like, people tend to improve. The Doctor learns to be a better person as, like, Moffat's run goes on. He gets the chance to make similar decisions, and he makes different choices each time, and they get a little bit better every time he goes along, showing, like, real progress and growth. And there's something, like, deeply cynical but also deeply affecting in Davies' idea that, and again, part of me is worried about being reductive and kind of like boiling it down to that kind of thing we talked about with the AIDS crisis and the way in which he's talked about feeling like a survivor and feeling like he survived something that was horrific and kind of like wiped out a large segment of a certain part of British culture. But you have this idea at the start of his run of Doctor Who, the Doctor has wiped out Gallifrey to end the Time War.
Yeah.
He's destroyed his own people. He is the last survivor. He is a wandering god. He is lonely and he's isolated. And then you get to the end of his time on Doctor Who. And again, I'm going to assume that listeners have maybe are at least familiar with the End of Time. But you have the Doctor essentially repeating that at the End of Time. Gallifrey comes back, but he doesn't restore it. He instead opts to, again, cut himself off from it again and to cast Gallifrey back into the Time War. And it's interesting that here, at the start of Children of Earth, Jack sacrifices a bunch of children to save humanity, right?
Yeah.
And then 44 years later, at the end of Children of Earth, he sacrifices a child to save humanity, and in doing so cuts himself off from the world around him. And it's kind of interesting how the character is somewhat destined to repeat that mistake, or destined to repeat that decision. Because again, that's something that we come back to. Like, the sequence where he has the grandchild hooked up to the machine, like, that recalls any number of Davies finales with wires. Parting of the Ways is a big one as well, where the Doctor's going to, like, genocide Earth again. And he opts not to in that case. But here he does opt to push the button. And I find it interesting that for Davies, part of character is the fact that you are doomed to repeat these cycles over and over again. And there maybe is no escape for them. There is no redemption. There is no happy ending. Jack doesn't get to redeem the loss of the children at the start of this story. He just gets to repeat it. Maybe for a better cause. Maybe for a better purpose. Maybe in the hopes of preventing it from happening again. But he still has to do the same thing, which is to choose a bunch of children, tell that child it's going to be okay, and then sacrifice them for what he perceives to be the greater good.
I mean, so thinking about Jack's journey at the end here as well, and the epilogue scene 6 months later, do you think this is the point where torture should have ended?
It very much does work, Sonia, because as far as I'm aware, like, Miracle Day, he kind of just turns up because the miracle happens.
Yeah, and of course, you haven't seen Miracle Day. What do you think, Darren?
Yeah, I mean, not to get too spoilery about Miracle Day, you're going to have a discussion about that with somebody else. But I do think that Miracle Day is a sizable step down in quality from, obviously, Children of Earth. I do think this would have been the perfect place to leave Torchwood. And I think the cultural memory of the show would maybe be a little bit better if it was. I mean, I was doing research for this and I discovered the AV Club ranked this like the fifth or sixth best miniseries of the 21st century. Across any genre.
Wow.
Like, right up there with, like, Generation Kill and The Plot Against America. This was like, Torchwood, Children of Earth, one of the greatest things on television this century.
Yeah, I can't help but agree. I think it's brilliant. I think it would have been, as bleak as it was, it feels like the end. It's the end of, you know, Jack literally cuts his ties off with humanity, you said, and leaves. He says his place is too small, the whole place is like a graveyard. And that's the end of his journey. It started with series one, and then ends here when he leaves.
Well, it's again, we mentioned this idea of like the Letts Dick's era of Doctor Who being kind of like a big influence on like Davies' vision of what Doctor Who could be or should be. And it's like at the end of this, basically Jack has become even more of the Doctor. He's now a wanderer who is running away.
Yeah.
Like, again, that's again, arguably one of the big differences between Moffat and Davies, this discussion of what the Doctor's relationship to Gallifrey was and why the Doctor is going where he's going and whether he's running away from or running towards something or running with any purpose or whatever. But the idea is that at the end of this show, Jack is running away from all this pain, all this shame, all this suffering, all this horrible stuff that he did. And that is exactly where Davies found the Ninth Doctor in Rose. So it feels to me like that is maybe the perfect place for Davies to more or less wrap up his run, allowing for the victory lap upon victory lap of the end of time.
Yeah.
You know?
It does have that sense of finality in that final scene, because not only is it just like wrapping up that, but you then get the mentions of like Susie, Owen and Tosh as well, the people he's lost during the series.
And I think while it would be reductive to say, oh, Gwen gets married, has a baby, is the end, you know, there's much more to Gwen Lee. At least they have their happy ending too as well. So, you know, Gwen's story you feel like Gwen's story is very much going to keep going, but the idea of Gwen in the kind of Torchwood we knew is kind of done as well. If different priorities have changed as well, and obviously Torchwood's gone.
Just, we didn't really talk about Agent Johnson, just to talk about very briefly, but I think she's a fascinating character because she's introduced as, again, it's very similar to, ironically, the character she seems to pair with is Andy, where Andy is this guy who wears a police uniform and who at the climax of the story casts off the costume of the state and decides to fight for what's right. Where Johnson is this person who has done these terrible things for her belief in the country. She's done what she's told to do. I think she talks about it in episode 4 and episode 5. She's done the things because she thought she was serving the country. And then she makes the decision to turn against the government. and she is the instigator in Day 5. Day 5 does not happen without Agent Johnson, which is an incredible piece of writing, given that, like, Johnson is introduced as this female Terminator, as this kind of, like, Black Widow-esque figure who's, like, just murdering people left, right, and center in Day 1 and Day 2. But at the end of this, she's the character who ultimately saves the day by getting everybody back together, telling Jack to pull his head out of his arse. I love that she goes to Them's house and just takes all the equipment and also takes Decker.
Yes.
One of those quietly satisfying moments is Decker running into the cupboard, asking what's going on and getting the butt of a gun to his face for his trouble.
Every but time the fact Rick that... gets hit or shot is great.
But like the fact that she ends up being the show's conscience because she's willing to do the thing that Frobisher can't, which is think about her function outside of being a unit of state policy.
Yeah.
I think that's just really, really good writing, and I absolutely love it, and I think it's central to the show. That is all I have to say there. Oh, and also, just to throw it out there, we're finishing up, gonna throw a grenade out there to the listeners. I do think there is something interesting in this being a story about children that is also a story about two gay men coming out and being in a relationship together, and the idea that so much of this is about the British government talking about what people matter and what people don't, and the idea that historically... one of the justifications of, like, state-sponsored homophobia has been the idea that gay men can't be, quote-unquote, families because they don't have children, because they don't subscribe to the model of reproduction as the family unit. And I find it interesting, whether consciously or not, that Davies is kind of playing with that here, where you have this story that is at once about how these two gay men are in a relationship and truly love one another, and also the government doesn't actually care about children at all. Outside of an instrument of state policy. I think there's an interesting tension there. I'm not the one to unpack it, and we're wrapping up, so I'm going to throw that grenade into the air.
What a grenade, yeah, definitely. So, but it's been really good to chat about. I say, we probably could have chatted for 6 more hours on this, but it's been good, I know. But in the meantime, then, thank you for coming on for Tires Crew again. Where can people find you online if you want to talk to a doctor or anything else of you?
All right, so you can follow me. I'm at Darren_Mooney on Twitter. I co-host a podcast called The 250 with my good friend Andrew Quinn. We are lining up for April Fool's Day, which is falling on a Saturday this year. We're hoping to cover some of the Chucky films, so you can join us for that discussion. We're going to be discussing Child's Play. It's going to be Andrew's first time watching them, despite the fact that he thinks, quote-unquote, Chucky is his guy. Which is quite something for somebody who's never seen a film with Chucky in it. So we'll be doing that in April. Really looking forward to it. I'm at The Escapist. I publish several articles weekly there. I do In the Frame on Mondays and Fridays. I do Out of Focus on Wednesdays. And I also do film reviews. So if you want some of Darren's crazy pop culture opinions, you can find those there. But you can also just reach out to me on Twitter. I've also published books on like The X-Files of Christopher Nolan. If you are listening to this podcast, I suspect you may be interested in Doctor Who. If you are... last year with Obverse Books, I was very lucky. I got to publish what's basically a dream for me, which was one of their Black Archive series covering Kill the Moon, which is a story that I think is one of the most important stories Doctor Who has ever told. I hope I get to make a good case for it. People who've read it, even where they disagree with me, seem to think that it's a good argument. So if you want to check that out, please feel free to do so. You can order it from Amazon, from wherever good bookstores are found. Cheers.
Brilliant. Thanks, Darren. And you can follow the TARDIS crew on Twitter by searching Crew TARDIS, Instagram by searching the TARDIS crew. So yeah, thanks for joining us for this latest episode. And remember, we are part of the We Made This podcast network. Please subscribe to the TARDIS crew and give us a rating and review on our podcast, and it really helps get us new listeners too. We'll continue to bring more regular Big Finish reviews, but our main episode in April sees us look back at another anniversary special of Doctor Who, The Five Doctors, with returning guest Mark Adams.
A very much a lighter topic.
definitely a lighter topic this time around.
Yeah, a lighter topic in the death zone.
In the death zone, absolutely, death zone. Yeah. So join us again for the TARDIS crew, because somewhere there's danger, somewhere there's injustice, and somewhere else the tea's getting cold.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.